Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. And on the show today, to begin the show, we are going to talk about the past, the present, and the future of Milwaukee's iconic plant conservatory, the Mitchell Park Domes. And a couple of guests for you today. With us from the domes, Doris Mackey, Mitchell Park Domes Director. She was appointed in 2019. She leads the facilities, operations, and seasonal shows. Doris, welcome. Thank you for joining us today.
Hi, good morning, Larry. Thank you. So happy to be here.
Well, really happy to have you with us. And with us as well, Justine Miller, horticulturist for the Desert Domes Arid Collection. And Justine, welcome to you.
Thank you, Larry. Great to be here.
I'm looking forward to talking with you both, and I'm sure our listeners are as well. And as you listen in, by the way, have you visited the domes? What do you enjoy most about it? What questions do you have about caring for all of those plants? Love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Doris, let's start with you. Tell us what you do as director of the domes.
All right. I love that question. Yes, like you said, I've started here in August of 2019. So I've been at the domes for a little bit of over 6 years now. Such a pleasure for me. I have also been part of Milwaukee County Parks since 2008. So my career with parks led me here to the domes. And I currently lead a group of about 12 full-time employees, as well as 6 to 8 seasonal employees. There's two teams, the horticultural team. Justine is part of that team. There is also the visitor team. So it's kind of like sometimes we call front of the house, back of the house. Horticultural team is in charge of all plant care, the rotating exhibits. We also have a greenhouse complex that is attached to the domes. So sometimes you might not see it if you're coming and staying in the front parking lots. But if you come a little bit further behind the domes is the greenhouse complex, and that is 6 growing greenhouses, which we manage. And that's where we do all the magic in growing plants. And there is also another greenhouse space that is a rental space for private rentals. If you ever think of weddings at the domes and holiday parties at the domes, that's a space that is used for that. The visitor team is the team that you see when you enter to visit us. Those are all the people that work with admissions, and also sometimes special events during public hours, and all the permits, the photo permits and wedding ceremonies. So I lead both of those teams and do everything I can to make sure they have the resources to keep the domes beautiful and the visitors happy when they come and visit us.
Yeah, you got a lot going on there. That's for sure. And Justine, you're one cog in that wheel. Tell us about your role and responsibilities.
Yeah, so I have been here at the domes for almost 5 years now. I'm the curator of the Arid Dome, so take care of all of the plants in that dome, as well as adding both seasonal and permanent collections. Most recently, we developed a new bed representing a new continent in the Arid Dome, and that's Southwestern Asia. So right now, the Arid Dome shows plant communities from 5 different continents, everything except for Europe and Antarctica. So we try to show plants kind of grouped by country or by continent to kind of show what they might look like in the wild. So I take care of that dome. And on the other side of the spectrum, I'm also responsible for our new paludarium, which is a bog style garden, which is much, much wetter than the Arid Dome, which we actually just introduced yesterday into our lobby. So that features a bunch of different carnivorous plants. We had a carnivorous plant display before, which was only able to display terrestrial carnivorous plants, but the new one also has epiphytic, aquatic, and completely submerged carnivorous plants as well. So pretty excited about that new addition too.
You don't want anybody strolling through the bogs then with the carnivorous plants.
No, they can come right in here and stay dry and check it out right now.
Just teasing a little bit. You know, I'm going to admit something to you. I've loved the domes. I've visited, you know, a number of times. But I go back. The first time the domes started was about the time that I started here at Wisconsin Public Radio. I think Desert Dome, if I'm not mistaken, it opened in 1967.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that's when I started here on Wisconsin Public Radio. So I've got a long time. But there's a history of this area, of the domes area, the Mitchell Park domes, that goes back long before that. Doris, are you know, what are the, there was an earlier park that the domes kind of replaced.
Right. Yes. Originally, there was a horticultural conservatory in the park already that had been in place for a number of years. And when it was time to replace it, that's where the dream of the domes kind of started. And Donald Grieve was the local architect who won the design competition. And then construction of the domes began in 1959. And you were mentioning the Desert Dome, which was the second one. The first one to open was the Show Dome.
Yeah.
And that was in December of 1964. And then it goes to the Tropical Dome, 1966. So then the Desert Dome that you were mentioning is the last one. Is that correct, Justine? The Desert Dome was the last one to open in 1967. So there is a lot of history, even before the domes, of having a horticultural destination and oasis in Mitchell Park, in the heart of Milwaukee.
Yeah, great thing for the city of Milwaukee. I mean, the domes are a lot, such an iconic place for people and a place to really be proud of, I think. If I'm not mistaken, even Lady Bird Johnson, president's wife, was in town to dedicate them, if I'm not mistaken,
yes,
back in the 60s.
Yes, that is correct. Yeah, the facility was dedicated by First Lady, Mrs. Lady Bird Johnson. So, yeah, that took place here.
So the design and construction of the domes, the architect, what a visionary he was.
Certainly, yeah, certainly. At that time, it was a modern marvel, as it's been called. You know, it still is.
It still is.
We still want it to be, because look at the domes. I mean, people, you know, not only is a horticultural oasis, it's also an architectural marvel and something so distinctive in the Milwaukee skyline. We do have visitors that come to visit us, and they do not know that we are a horticultural conservatory. They just come because they have seen them from the freeway, and they're, what is that? It is amazing. We want to be there. So they come, and they're at the fee booth, and they just said it looks so beautiful, but we don't know what's inside. So they love it even more once they tour and they know what it is. But that's definitely.
Yeah. And there's touring and as you were alluding to, there are so many events. I mean, I was part of an event myself. I'm trying to remember the year now. I've forgotten the year, but it's a while back. But I was. We did an evening show at the domes. I and Melinda Myers. Who you may or may you're smiling.
Yes, of course. We know Melinda.
Everybody knows her. We had a marvelous time there, and I suppose it's been a way to weddings and events like that are way sort of ways to bring additional monies into the program.
Yeah, that is true. And just mentioning Melinda, she is Melinda Meyer is such a good friend of the Domes, such a great advocate for the work that we do. She definitely is helping us bring the word out in the community in the work that we do in the Domes and joining us in what is the future of the Domes. But in terms of events, yes, you're correct. There's a lot of special events and private events. We actually just had a fantastic event this past weekend, the All Scale Train Exhibit. And that's an event that has grown. We have the annual train show is taking place right now in the Show Dome. So when you come to visit us, you'll see four different, tracks and trains running through the beautiful plants. But we also had trains in different exhibitors, about 24 different exhibitors that were in the lobby and in Greenhouse 7 that I was saying that's the additional event space. So there were trains everywhere, and that is such an awesome event for the community. Over almost, we have about 7,000 people in 2 days coming to visit the Domes. So that's really great, and we thank everyone who came and had fun with us, because we certainly did. And, there's more events coming. There'll be an event coming up soon in March, and then Art in the Green. I'm sure a lot of people have heard of Art in the Green. That is a 2-day event in April. We have a lovely celebration in October, Dia de los Muertos. And Justine is a very big part of that, because that takes place in the Desert Dome. And that's also so important for our community, because it's a lovely event to celebrate the community we live on here in Mitchell Park in the near south side of Milwaukee. So, yes, events is also part of what we do. And we love
them. Talking today with Doris Mackey, Mitchell Park Domes Director, and Justine Miller, horticulturist for the Desert Domes Arid Collection. Questions for them or comments, maybe a word about your own visits, what you liked, or maybe where other questions you may have about the dome itself. Are the domes themselves, give a call to number 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. In the second hour of the show today, we'll talk with the editors of a new book. It's titled Living Roots, and it's an anthology on the promise of perennial food. So we're looking forward to that. Right now, we're taking a look at the Mitchell Park Domes with its director, Doris Mackey, and the horticulturist for the Desert Domes Arid Collection, Justine Miller. And you can call in at 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. And let's take a call. Susie in Manitowoc, what's on your mind? Thank you for calling.
I just have a really fun comment. Thank you for taking the call. Okay. Several years ago, my husband Jim and I directed the Manitowoc Two Rivers YMCA Boy Choir. We took our choir to sing, to visit at the domes, and ask if we could sing there, and they said yes. So the boys sang in the temperate dome.
Oh, I'll bet that was beautiful.
It was so much fun and so memorable. It was so long ago, I wonder how the boys remember it now, but it was a blast. It's like we felt so special.
Oh, thank you so much for calling, Susie. Doris, you probably weren't around, or Justine, neither one of you, when Susie, it sounds like it was more than 6 years ago. Is there music as part of the domes on occasion? Obviously there was.
Yes, in the rays, we do have most of our music and performers, we do have a lot of events in the holidays. During the holiday show, that's where we do have choirs. We have welcomed different choirs and different performers. So that's when you can expect to see the most. And then some other events that we do after hours, and Milwaukee Domes Alliance, who does events with us, they have performers as well. So yes, there's still music at the domes.
Susie, thanks again for calling. Carol in Madison, we'll go to you. Hi, Carol.
Oh, hi. Thanks. Say, I grew up in Brookfield, so Milwaukee was kind of my home city, and the domes were always something to be proud of, and it was always exciting when we were driving by on the expressway to peer out the window and see the domes. And when I heard last June that Milwaukee committed $30 million in capital funding for the restoration of the domes, I thought Milwaukee did the right thing. So I just wanted to thank Larry for featuring the domes today, and I love hearing from Doris Mackey and Justine Miller today on what's happening there today.
Oh, Carol, thank you so much. And you sort of lead us right into some additional conversation here. There's money coming through. Let's get the background on this. I mean, it costs a lot of money.
True. It does. it certainly does.
I think of water, I think of heat. And the backdrop of this is that funding had sort of not kept up with need for talk about that a little bit, Doris.
Yeah, that is correct. And you probably, first of all, I want to say thank you to Carol for mentioning that, because we also think that Milwaukee County did the right thing in allocating $30 million to the restoration of the domes. And that is in partnership with the Milwaukee Domes Alliance, who is leading the campaign for the Domes Reimagined plan, which is the future of the domes. But Larry, you're correct. It takes a lot of resources, and in those resources, of course, is funding money to maintain the domes, to keep the doors open, the lights on, and the plants watered. So yes, and there's been deferred maintenance for the facility, and that is something that you can see if you come and visit us today, and you come here on a rainy day, and you will know that the glass needs to be replaced, right? Because there's a lot of leaks, more than the plants like, and Justine can attest more about that. Happening in her dome. So yes, the domes do need to be restored. It is time, and that's what we're heading, and we're excited about that path.
Oh, I would imagine. So Justine, maybe talk about structural problems that may complicate what you have to do in the desert domes.
Yeah, so as you can imagine, the desert dome, especially this time of year when it's pretty cold, everything likes to stay very dry. And so that is where we run into a lot of trouble in the winter, especially, is when we get these major snow events or sometimes rain events and get all the leaking into the desert dome. Most of those plants are sleeping this time of year. They've gone dormant. And so the combination of the cool temperatures and then the moisture in the soil can really cause some trouble with root rot. And unfortunately, we've lost some specimens due to that over the last couple winters.
Isn't there, as I'm thinking about this, I would assume that over the course of the year that the conditions in the desert dome, they need to be changed. Like right now, I'm sure that you're not watering very much, and things are probably cooler, I'm guessing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. A lot of people get very surprised when they walk into the desert dome this time of year, and they're like, oh, it's cold in here. I would have thought the desert would be hot. But, you know, just like our Wisconsin plants, many desert plants go through seasonal changes, and we do keep it pretty cool in the wintertime. So we keep it around 60 degrees max in the winter, and that allows some of the North American species to kind of go dormant. And it also kind of wakes up the South African species. So you'll see a lot of aloes actually flowering this time of year because they prefer to grow in the cooler season.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And visitor, do you get a lot of questions? I mean, are you there to answer questions of people when they come through?
Yes. Yep. Yeah, we get a lot of interesting questions.
What's the most common?
Oh, honestly, the most common is probably what is the blue ball hanging in my dome? We do have this big blue ball hanging, and in the daytime it becomes kind of confusing to figure out what it is, but at night we light it up and it becomes the moon, and you can actually see it from outside. It's pretty magical at night, but a lot of people can't quite figure it out during the day, which is reasonable.
How many plants do you care for in the dome?
Oh, wow, that's a big question. I think the at last count, it was around, it was over 800.
Yes.
Individuals.
Yeah. I would say that's about right for the entire conservatory. For
my dome, actually.
Oh, just for your dome? I thought it was, we had something in the thousands then for the entire mm-hmm. conservatory.
Oh, man. So the placement and the kinds of, and let's just zero in on the desert dome as long as we're talking about it. You've got all of these different areas. How are those determined? And I mean, there's got to be a lot of planning going into this.
Yeah, so I think the idea from the beginning was kind of to try to display different deserts from around the world. But that said, a lot of the specimens, especially the larger specimens, were just kind of plopped around in what we call our oasis. We have a little pond in the desert dome. So as the years went on, previous horticulturists have tried to make the delineation more apparent. So we've really tried to have a Madagascar collection in one area and then a South African collection in another area. And it actually goes down to, once you hit North America, you can actually see a few different individual deserts. So we have the Sonoran, the Baja Desert, and the Chihuahuan Desert all represented individually. But because this has been kind of an ongoing process over many kind of generations of horticulturists, every now and then you'll see a palm or something that isn't quite in the right spot.
Oh, we just got an email. Does that moon thing do anything for the desert plants? Do they need that to signify it's night for the cycles or something?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I get that a lot. But no, it's actually just aesthetic. It's just kind of for the ambiance for our evening events.
Yeah, it makes sense. Mary in Green Bay has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Larry. It's just a comment that I was in Chicago last year, and we went to the Lincoln Park domes, and the first plant we saw in the fern dome with all the ferns, it's tropical, was a large, very large, right up to the ceiling plant with these long pods hanging on it that looked like sausages. And the docent who showed us all the plants and knew everything, she said, well, this plant has a mate, and it's in the Mitchell Park domes in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So we were pretty tickled about that. And I don't know the name of the plant, but she was amazed that we were from Wisconsin, my sister and I, and that we had, you know, been to the Mitchell Park domes. So it was just a neat event.
Oh, a neat event. Thanks, Mary. Well, what was you guys know what that plant was? Justine,
yeah, she had it. It's called the sausage tree, based on those fruits that she was describing. And yes, Amanda in our tropical dome actually trades flowers with someone from Chicago, and they pollinate each other's plants. And that's the only way we're able to get the fruit, is they need to cross-pollinate. So it's a pretty cool connection that we have.
You know, just thinking about trees, I've been to the many, as well as to the Mitchell Park domes. I've also been to the, I guess you'd call it a dome. It's a dome at Olbrich Botanical Gardens. And there I noticed, I asked somebody about the trees in there because they grow pretty tall. And I'm thinking, it made me think, you got to do a lot of trimming. I mean, they have to cut the tops off or whatever they do for that old brick. But it also, as I'm thinking about this, if you aren't pruning or doing something, you're going to be shading out. I mean, can you talk about that a bit?
Yes. So there is a lot of pruning that goes on here, mostly in the tropical dome, as you might imagine,
right,
as that's the collection that grows the fastest and is the most dense. And so you're right. They will keep growing and outgrow their space without the pruning, and they do shade out a lot of the understory. So in order to try to get as much diversity and different levels of plants as we can in the domes, we do have to prune regularly. And in the tropical dome, we do this twice a year. And then in the other two, we do it once a year. And we do this by renting a giant lift. So we have to get up in the lift and prune that way. And it's a pretty big event. Usually about half of each dome is closed as it's being pruned, but a lot of people like to watch the process, and it is quite an event to see some huge trees getting pruned. So it's kind of not one of the events that we advertise, certainly, but a lot of people are interested in watching that as well.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. I'm wondering about water too. How is the amount of water? How's it all regulated? What's the, you know, what do we, if I went downstairs and looked in the basement, shall we say, what would I find down there?
Oh, so we do have quite a huge cistern. I don't remember off the top of my head how many gallons it holds. But that's where we, have our fertilizers. So every, I would say 3 to 6 months, we have to fill this gigantic cistern with just bags and bags and bags of fertilizer. And we actually use a large ore to dissolve it and then pour it in. As far as the watering goes, a lot of people are surprised to hear that we actually hand water everything. We don't have any kind of irrigation set up. Everything is hand watered. So as you might imagine, the tropical dome gets the most water, so it gets watered almost every single day in there. And then on the other end of the spectrum, the desert dome, I haven't watered the whole collection in there in over a month. So keep it pretty dry over the whole winter. And then once we get around to summer, I usually water once a week in the summertime. And then the show dome, of course, is somewhere in between, depending on what show and the time of season that we've got.
So you're doing this by hand. So your arms must get pretty good, strong. I imagine those in the tropical dome have pretty strong arms. I mean, are you carrying, you know, typical sprinkling cans?
We do use about 100-foot hoses.
Okay.
So thankfully, yeah, we have different taps throughout the domes that we can hook up to. So we've got that for us, but it's in the desert dome, there is a lot more spot watering. So you might see me walking around with a watering can.
And I'm wondering, is there a collection area? I'm just kind of interested in this part of it. I mean, do you collect rainwater, for example, or is that not, go ahead and talk about that.
So we do collect rainwater off of the roofs of all of our greenhouses, and that gets held in a separate cistern that all of our propagation houses run almost 100% on rainwater. And then our carnivorous plants also get to benefit from that because they can't handle tap water. They can't handle water with a lot of dissolved minerals, so they get the rainwater as well. So the whole production part of the facility is run on rainwater.
So it's not you're not taking from the municipal supply to any to a great extent that somebody might imagine, I guess is what I was getting to.
Yeah, I think in the conservatory part is primarily City of Milwaukee water. And in the greenhouses, we use this sky harvester. It's a rain harvesting system, and we're pretty fortunate to have that. Of course, the greenhouse complex is much, it's a much newer facility. That facility opened, I believe it was 2013, and compared to the domes that are over 60, and I believe the original design of the domes was meant to harvest some rainwater. But, you know, due to some of the deferred maintenance issues that we see, that that's not currently, you know, how it's being used. So we don't have that harvester in the dome side.
Yeah, I was thinking probably, and somebody had mentioned in a note that wondering about the huge rain event that occurred, when was it, last summer? What'd you get,
right,
15,
August.
14 inches or something like that? I wonder what impact that had on the domes.
So luckily we were not impacted in any sorts of like flooding events. So that was not an issue for us. And then for the, I'm not sure at what stage we were in the sky harvester, if we were already full, but we could accumulate and be able to accommodate quite a bit of water. I think it's 80,000 gallons of water. I don't know, Justine, do you have more accurate numbers on that?
That sounds familiar, but I can't confirm that.
Yeah, but okay. In any case, we would have been able to gain quite a bit of water from that rain event. We, you know, the 80,000 gallons is what the maximum that we can collect.
Mike emailed wondering if you do anything to prevent unwanted plants from being introduced into the domes.
That's a good question. So we do get weeds. A lot of people are surprised that we get weeds inside the domes, but we get them through our venting system. So we do have fans that run and vent out the air. Air gets circulated quite a bit through the facility, and with that come seeds and occasionally insects that through our vents. So yeah, I do get dandelions in the dome sometimes. And we get plants, weeds from different plants, you know, that we bring in. So not a whole lot you can do, but there is a good portion of our time is spent weeding in the domes as well.
And I'm wondering about, so weeding reminds me of people to do the weeding. And I mean, you can't do everything yourself. And you probably, I'm assuming, rely, and you may have mentioned this, but on volunteer help. Do you have a volunteer association or some group that assists in projects at the domes?
Yeah, we do have regular volunteers that come in typically on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and they help out a lot with picking up leaf litter and sweeping and doing all the little tasks that, yeah, you're right, we don't necessarily always have time to do. So it's much appreciated help.
I want to talk with you about the future. We were talking about that $30 million and how it's going to be spent, and a little about the community itself, the community that the parks live in, I guess we could say, or the people that are around the parks.
Yeah.
Because I know there's things going on with that. So, but before we do that, just a reminder that we're talking with Doris Mackey, Mitchell Park Domes Director, and Justine Miller, who is the horticulturist for the Desert Domes Arid Collection. I bet if you had a question about a cactus or anything else, she'd be the first to be able to answer it for you. If you want to join in with that or just a question about the domes, the number's 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Next week on Garden Talk, we will be broadcasting live from the PBS Wisconsin Garden and Green Living Expo. I'll be interviewing Brian Huddleston, Dr. Death, and Lisa Johnson. Brian, of course, a plant pathologist, and he's interested in plant diseases, among other things. Lisa Johnson, the Dane County Horticulture Specialist, will be joining us to take your gardening questions. That's the second to the last. I'll have one more live show in front of a live audience, I guess I should say, in June. Late May. And then that'll be the last one. For this one, I think there were 400 tickets. I think they're all pretty much all gone for people to come and see. But it's going to be a lot of fun, and I'm going to stick around a little afterwards with Jill Nadeau, and we'll answer other questions that may not relate to gardening necessarily. Let's put it that way. We'll talk a little about what's going on with me and so forth. So, looking forward to that next week on Garden Talk. But right now we're taking a look at the Mitchell Park Domes with Doris Mackey, the director there, and Justine Miller, horticulturist for the Domes, Desert Domes Arid Collection. And Patricia in Milwaukee has a comment or question. Let's go there. Patricia, hi.
Aloha, Larry, and aloha to all the people from the Domes. I'm a member of the Domes Alliance, and I was just at the train show and the Wonders of the World, and it is the most incredible show that I have seen in a long time. The Wonders of the World just is so amazing, and they're the Domes' original Arboretum is one that I know of from my childhood days. So I'm just totally thrilled with our Domes and so proud of them. And the people from my family reunion are going to be going to the Domes in August.
Patricia, thank you so much for calling. Patricia said aloha, and Patricia and I spent a week in Hawaii together. Well, there were a lot of other WPR listeners as well. We spent a week on a WPR-sponsored trip to Hawaii. But that train show, obviously, Doris, is a beaut.
Yeah, thank you. Sorry about that.
Yeah, no, go ahead. It's amazing that you had so many people coming.
Yes, and I just want to say thank you to Patricia for coming to visit us and for being a member of the Milwaukee Domes Alliance. That's just one of the many ways you can support us. But I'm so happy that she enjoyed it and came to visit, and that more of her family are coming. That's pretty much what the Domes are for. It's a place for gathering and making memories and bringing people together. And we love that this could be a place that can do that at the same time as connecting people with nature and teaching in the field of horticulture. So thank you so much.
You know, and the Domes have been going on for around 60 years now. And obviously, over that time, as we've talked about, there's a need for updating. And you, Doris, talked about, you now have $30 million put toward the Dome. But talk about the planning process that took place for that. Because my understanding is that it was quite extensive over several years.
That is correct. Over several many years of planning and researching and collaborating. And we're very, very grateful to the Milwaukee Domes Alliance because, yes, we've said it in the show, Milwaukee County committed to $30 million to the Domes restoration, to the Domes Reimagined project. And a big, big partner of this, we cannot do it without them, we do this together, is the Milwaukee Domes Alliance. So in this name, Milwaukee Domes Alliance is fairly a new name, but this is not a new group. This is a group of friends. You might remember them as the Friends of the Domes. They have been supporters and friends of the Domes for over 30 years for sure, and they continue to do so. And they're the ones that, in partnership with Milwaukee County Parks, envisioned and developed this plan forward, this Domes Reimagine, this future of the domes. And the whole project requires more than the $30 million commitment from Milwaukee County. It's about $140 million project in different phases. And the Milwaukee Domes Alliance will be leading the philanthropic campaign for private donations, as well as seeking additional funding that could be in the form of grants and all kinds of sources, like local or state or even federal funding. So I do want to really mention them again and encourage people to visit their website, MilwaukeeDomes.org. Again, is MilwaukeeDomes.org if you want to learn more about the Domes Reimagine project. And a huge shout out to Krista Beal Diefenbach, who is the executive director of the Milwaukee Domes Alliance and leads a phenomenal team and works with us together to keep the domes, the beloved domes, a place in the community, a place for all and for many years to enjoy.
You know, I was looking at some of the plans, or at least in a very broad sense, the plans. So you're looking at freshly programmed and animated domes, of course. And one of the things I liked about it was the power it has to significantly improve the neighborhood quality of life, the education and employment. The Clark Square neighborhood is an opportunity investment zone, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct.
Talk about
yes.
that a little bit.
Yes, and we are very close to that neighborhood community, work with them as well. So, yes, the Domes Reimagine plan not only is focusing on restoring the domes, it's also an opportunity to revitalize Mitchell Park, to bring people to the park to enjoy the conservatory and the park as well. We work with many neighborhood organizations, and Milwaukee Domes Alliance is making sure that we are including our community and our neighbors in the future of the domes. So yes, we do. We're very proud of that. We're very proud of playing such a vital role in our neighborhood and in our community. And our neighbors are so nice to us. They are the ones that, you know, tell us what they like or what we could do better or more. And they're always keeping us safe. And just it's really a lovely community to be in. We really want to be in Mitchell Park. This is the best place for the domes.
Yeah, I think I would definitely agree with that. I was looking. There's probably a new welcome center that's going to be coming in. You're going to have some retail and education and research fund as well, a hub.
Yes, we do have an education center right now, and again, it's led by the Milwaukee Domes Alliance. We have a gift shop as well, so those amenities will be expanded. So it'll be bigger, better. There will also be a new cafe. That is something that I think our visitors are going to love, because they always ask for that. It's not an amenity that we have at the moment. So a new cafe, a new children's area, a new interactive area for kids. And that's also going to be a great, great asset for the visitors to make the visitor experience even better, because this is a place for family. We see a lot of families, especially now with the train show. But not every area is an area where, you know, kids can touch and interact. Imagine Justine's dome, the desert dome. So this, you know, new interactive play area that is designed in the plan for the future of the domes is going to be really great for families.
And I saw a farm-to-table restaurant. I saw food trucks.
Well, yeah, that's always the plan when we think about even special events that we can take outside. And again, and that speaks of including the park and revitalizing the park. Part of the plan does include that additional or bigger space for an education center. And also there's an area here in Mitchell Park, and some of our listeners and visitors might know, known as the Sunken Garden. Mm-hmm. And we did, Mitchell Park did have sunken gardens before, no longer there. But this plan will be using that space as well. And there will be a garden as well there, a boardwalk interactive garden for the community.
And I think a fresh pond and reflecting pool, you know, it sounded, and more pathways. Sounded like there was... There's a lot going on outside the domes as well as within.
Yes, that's true. There's a lot going on outside in the park. So it's a beautiful and exciting path. And the plants, I think if people would like to see some of the renderings and what we're talking about, the Milwaukee Domes Alliance is the website to see that. They do have renderings, and they have more of the details on how this is going to be done in phases. It's going to be phase one, phase two, phase three. It's not going to happen all at once, as you can imagine. But we're very excited for what is coming for the domes and the community.
Magdalena sent an email. She grew up in Milwaukee and loved visiting the domes. And here's an interesting question from her. If you had an unlimited budget, what kinds of things would you want to include in programming for community outreach and or education programs? If money was no object, I guess.
If money was no object, well, there's already a lot of the dreams are included in this plan, but I don't know. We think about the facility space, and maybe that could be incorporated when it's coming. Just a way for the public to be able to experience the conservatory a little bit from above. If there were a spiral staircase or an overlook tower or things like that, that will give the visitor the bird's eye view. That would be one of my wishes. If the budget and the space was not you know, you have to consider the limitations of the space as well and the plants. Justine, do you have favorite?
Maybe I would build the domes taller to support some more mature palm trees or something like that. Have some more landscape scale collections going.
Well, here's an email as we're kind of winding up here. But Lynn in Pewaukee emailed, they visited the domes, Lynn did, when she and her husband, when they were newlyweds living in the Polish flat in Milwaukee, they bought a little jade plant. And it has been a part of their lives for over 40 years, moving Wow. with them from house to house. So they bought that plant, I guess, at the domes. And here Wow. it is 40 years later. And I got to say, Lynn is probably the champion gardener, master gardener, perhaps. And that's a pretty cool legacy for that plant. And I want to thank you both for being mm-hmm. with us today. It's been a real pleasure to learn some more about what's going on with the domes. I'm really excited about as I'm sure you are as well, about what's going to happen in the next 5 to 10 years. And it's a treat to be there now, even. So now, don't wait for 10 years. Next time you're in the Milwaukee area, visit the domes. Doris Mackey, Mitchell Park Domes Director, and Justine Miller, horticulturist for the Desert Domes Arid Collection. Thanks to them, and thanks to you for listening, and I hope you stay with us. Coming up, we're going to talk about a new book out on our food systems. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News, and you stay with us. Great to have you along for Garden Talk today. Larry Mealer here. Glad to have you with us as we take up our discussion with our next two guests. And they have written that our food system functions kind of like fast fashion because plants are only in the ground for one season. And we're going to ask them to expand on that idea. Couple of guests for you. One, Aubrey Streit-Krug. Aubrey is a writer, a teacher, a researcher who studies human-plant relationships and the connection between cultural and agricultural change. She's the director of the Perennial Cultures Lab at the Land Institute. And Aubrey, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, great to see your smiling face, and great to see the smiling face of Liz Carlisle, an associate professor in the Environmental Studies program at UC Santa Barbara, where she teaches courses on food and farming. She's written three books about regenerative farming and agroecology, and together they have edited a new anthology with essays on perennial farming. It's called Living Roots, The Promise of Perennial Foods. And Liz Carlisle, thank you for joining in, too.
So happy to be here, Larry.
Well, as we talk with our authors and experts, I hope you'll join in. What are your thoughts on perennial crops? Are perennial foods part of your garden, perhaps? I'm betting they are. On Garden Talk, I can guarantee that a significant portion of the listeners to this show today are involved in perennial garden, and I'm hoping they join in with their own questions and thoughts as we talk about it from a farming perspective as well. You can give a call, the number 800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Now, when I think about perennial gardening, I think, okay, what plants are perennial? So we've got, I'll bet 90, well, maybe 70% at least of our listeners have a rhubarb patch. And they have many, not quite as many, would have an asparagus patch. And a whole bunch of people would have blueberries, or some would have blueberries, depending on the soil. And others would have raspberry patches and blackberry patches. So those are all perennial crops. So what about, give me a definition of perennial farming. Who wants
I'll jump in there, Larry. Yeah. So
ahead,
as your
Liz.
Listeners probably know, perennials are plants that live for more than 1 year. And so Aubrey and I are writing about perennial foods, which are foods that come from these perennial plants. So just as you said, you know, that'd be fruit trees, berry bushes, nut trees as well. Aubrey can tell you all about some really exciting novel perennial grains that scientists are working on with collaborating farmers. And then we also actually included animals that are raised on perennial pasture as really important foods that come from these perennial landscapes. And we're including everything from sort of the production farm context to the garden context to people who have relationships with these foods as foragers, because it's really about us as humans being stewards of these perennial landscapes and developing relationships with these perennial plants.
Let me ask you both this question. Maybe I'll start with you, Liz. How did you get involved in this approach to agriculture?
This is good, actually, because I've been around agriculture for 15 years, but I'm a little newer to this perennial party than Aubrey. So maybe this is one of those cases where nobody preaches like the converted. we just came off of the news. I don't know if folks have been listening since the news at the top of the hour, but it's so clear that we're dealing with a lot of crises at the same time. I'm really feeling the weight of that. The need to slow emissions, the need to adapt to the climate change that's already here, And then somehow at the same time to heal the deep divisions and inequity in our society that are making it so hard to tackle these big collective challenges like climate change and, you know, the extreme weather that a lot of Wisconsin farmers and just Wisconsins in general are really feeling. And so I came to perennial foods because I see these foods and the movement that's building around them as a really promising potential solution to actually help us do all of these things at the same time, to slow emissions, adapt, and come together across difference.
Yeah. Aubrey, what about you?
Well, I grew up here in Kansas, where I'm calling in from today, and my parents farm wheat, they raise cattle. So I grew up surrounded by both pastures and then annual cropping systems. And, you know, most of the staple foods that people that feed people around the world are these annual grains that just grow for 1 year. But in reality, most of the world's plants and most of the world's terrestrial ecosystems have been developed through the work of perennial, long-lived plants, from grasslands and prairies here on the Great Plains to forests and savannas to tundras. And so as I, through my own education, was trying to learn and think about what could make a food system that really lasts in this place, that could be sustainable and fit in a place over time, it makes sense to look towards perennials that have been here much longer, and the people and traditions who have developed around these foods that have been the cornerstones of our cuisines around the world before the growth of annual grains much more recently in human history. So I have been really inspired by the work of the Land Institute, where I now work, to think about how we can develop perennial food systems in across all of these areas, from forest-based work in agroforestry to grasslands and grazing systems to actual grain agricultures that feature perennials in a lot of diversity.
It's pretty cool. And you guys are both involved in an upcoming perennial farm gathering. When is it? March 11th through the 13th, if I'm not mistaken?
Indeed.
So this, maybe give us an overview of that event, and then I want to dive in some, you know, deeper into these areas that you're bringing up here. But what about this event?
Yeah, we're super excited about this. This is also going to be our book launch for Living Roots. So we actually haven't seen the hard copy yet, Larry, and we're all going to hold it together with a bunch of the contributors. There are 30 contributors to this book who work across all of those perennial systems that Aubrey was just talking about, as farmers, as researchers, as chefs. And the Perennial Farm Gathering is hosted by this really great organization based in Madison called the Savannah Institute. I'm lucky to be on their advisory board. And they make the point that the upper Midwest used to be a savanna ecosystem, these vast grasslands with trees dotting these grasslands. And it's a group of, you know, farmers and scientists and gardeners and interested folks who are working on things like hazelnuts and elderberries and all of these different perennial tree crops that can bring this savanna ecosystem back. And so for, over a decade now, they've been gathering folks who are interested in agroforestry and perennial farming. And it's just gotten bigger and bigger. Now there's over 400 people that go. And this year it's going to be in Dubuque, Iowa. So would definitely encourage folks to come on over, whether you're really excited about perennials already or whether you just want to be with a group of people working on something positive. I really love the energy of this group.
Yeah. And Aubrey, you mentioned you work for the Land Institute, and maybe you should tell us more about that as well.
Sure. So the Savannah Institute's amazing work is focused on agroforestry systems, and the Land Institute's work, we're really thinking about developing grain-based agricultural systems. So grains are these hard, dry, edible seeds of plants that we eat and value. And you can think about wheat or rice or corn, sorghum, all these really important crops. And they're, like I said, annual. So we're really developing the perennial versions of some of these annual crops, and also scientists at the Land Institute and collaborators around the world are developing novel perennial grains by domesticating plants that are already perennial and thinking about how the seeds they provide can be tasty and nutritious human food, but also how these very deeply rooted plants can provide all kinds of amazing ecological services and benefits to the places in which they're grounded. So your listeners might be familiar with Kernza perennial grain, for instance, which is being grown by farmers in the U.S. And is being used and developed in different products. And it's a pretty tasty food.
It is indeed. Talking with Liz Carlisle and Aubrey Streit Krug, together they have edited a new anthology, and we're going to dig into that, I guess we could. It's called Living Roots. So we'll dig into Living Roots, the promise of perennial foods. And I hope you'll join in with your own thoughts as we move along today. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Do you think it's possible for us to do this? Are you, maybe you farm yourself now and you raise a lot of corn or beans. What are your thoughts on this as well? 1-800-642-1234 is the number, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. On Monday's program, we'll be talking about technology issues with one of our tech experts, so, taking a look at screen time, among other things. But then we'll also turn to the Olympics, and we'll talk about the wearable technology that is being used at the Olympics. And right now we're talking about, in a way, it's an old technology. It's been around forever, but we're trying to bring it back a bit more as we visit with Liz Carlisle and Aubrey Streit Krug. Together they've edited a new anthology. It's called Living Roots, The Promise of Perennial Foods. And again, you can join in, the number 800-642-1234. You could email to talk@wpr.org. And you know what? Let's take some calls. Daniela in Green Bay, we'll give you a chance. Thanks for joining in. What's on your mind?
I was hoping your guest could speak to some of the practicalities of perennial farming that kind of mimics the ecosystem. I you know, looked into hazelnut, you know, kind of production that's being developed in the Midwest, and I wonder how much of the perennial agriculture is just going to be monocrops because of the efficiency and practicalities of harvest. So I was wondering if you could kind of speak to that a little bit.
Oh, good question, Daniela. And I hope you get a copy of their anthology, their book, because it addresses a lot of what you were talking about. We'll get into that more. But comments on Daniela's comments?
Yeah, I'll lead off and Liz can chime in. Yeah. Maybe we'll start with just the practicality of perennials. If we think about being able to have crops and food producing plants and systems that don't have to be replanted every year and require disturbance of the soil and replanting and retilling, that's a very practical benefit. And also having perennials that have very deep root systems that can more efficiently use nutrients, fertilizer, water can be really practical in terms of decreasing inputs in those systems and thinking about the labor required to tend and steward them as well. So we think about the value of these different perennial systems. Those are really benefits to pay attention to for people and land. And then if we think about the opportunities to build diversity into those systems, can think about even more resilience based upon changing conditions over time. So this is where there might be some practical benefits, like you were saying, Daniela, about the mechanization of harvest, to have everything ripen at the same time to be able to harvest. And there also can be benefits to having diversity in those systems for their resilience to pests and pathogens, and for their ability to adapt to changing weather. So having a diversity of crops on the landscape and in these agricultural systems can be really beneficial too.
Yeah. Liz, anything to add there?
Aubrey's got it.
And I was thinking about at least one of the authors that we're going to talk about who really has her farm system really operates the whole year round. I mean, there's something going on the whole year round with the way she operates. And we'll get into that in a bit, Daniela. I thank you for calling. Let's go to David in Shorewood, and then maybe we'll dig in a little deeper on the book. David, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hey, Larry. I've kind of gone down this rabbit hole this year, and I haven't done this before. But what I found was that a lot of the seed catalogs don't carry any or very few of these types of plants. And so I thought I'd share that Etsy is where I found a lot of things. They come in little Ziplocs labeled by hand. So I have like Hamburg parsley. I have salsify. I have lovage, skirret. Those are all seeds. From Territorial Seeds, I found cardoon and chervil. And then one other source, it was hard to find anybody who was still carrying roots. They may have in the past, but I was able to get a package of Wishka. So those are my new excursions from the normal seed packets this year.
Oh, well, David, thanks a lot for calling. Etsy.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so it brings the question of having the seeds, having the means and the products that you want to grow there.
Yeah, I mean, that was a big reason for the formation of the Savannah Institute, actually, and this perennial farm gathering is for folks to share information about what they needed that they didn't have and kind of scheme together about how to create some of those resources in terms of nursery stock and stuff like that. And they've ended up spinning off a business, the Savannah Institute Canopy Farm Management, that because they just had so many calls from folks more at the farm scale, wanting, you know, nursery stock or kind of help setting up these systems that were hard to find. But yeah, I love the sort of story about how we can also do this virtually through platforms like Etsy and share the seeds and the knowledge that we have.
Yeah. David, thank you. And Marjorie in Neenah, Wisconsin, we'll go to you. Hi, Marjorie.
Hi, Larry. Good to hear this program. I've always been interested in perennial wheat. I think it was Wes Jackson who pioneered it at the Salinas Institute in Kansas. And they've been working on Kernza or one of those other wheat variants. What progress have they made with perennializing wheat? That was my question.
Aubrey, you're sitting in Kansas. Kind of a wheat state.
Yes, the self-identified breadbasket. And you're right that the Land Institute has been working both on creating a perennial version of annual wheat, so crossing annual wheat that we know and enjoy in bread and pasta with its perennial wild relatives to try to create a perennial version of wheat. And we've been also working to domesticate a wheatgrass relative to create Kernza perennial grain. And these have been longstanding ideas to create a perennial grain, and the Land Institute has really dug in and advanced them almost over the last 50 years. We're coming up towards our 50th anniversary. So very exciting this year for us. And there has been a lot of progress made on understanding the yield potential of these crops and understanding the resources needed to make progress on them. So Kernza perennial grain has made steady progress on yield and has really demonstrated some of the ecological benefits. And we're seeing the potential to continue and increase that through the breeding efforts that are underway. So that's been wonderful to see it move from the nursery onto crop landscapes and into supply chains and products. And with perennial wheat, we're still working to find those right crosses, and tests are underway to see which of those perennial wheat plants can survive the hot summer, can survive the cold winter. And we have some really promising lines, but we'll see. We have to keep testing them in different environments. And that work is underway, not only in Kansas and the United States, but with partners around the world who are contributing to this global effort to work on perennial crops that can make sense in their places.
And actually, you two opened the, well, let's go back and review the book just so we set the stage, and then we'll take some more calls. Laura will, in Portage, we'll get to you in a minute here. But the book itself is, it's, I kind of like the anthology idea of it, to be honest. Once I started reading it, I questioned it at first, and then I thought, you know what, this isn't a bad way to do it. But you've portioned it into three areas, basically, and I think, Aubrey, you did mention them to begin with, but what, just talk about your organization of the book. Both of you can chime in. Liz, go ahead.
Yeah, so we kind of started off with an introduction that we wrote that, you know, mirrors the conversation we're having about why we think perennial foods are so significant in this moment and helpful to a lot of our major human and ecological challenges. And then the rest of the book proceeds in these three sections. We start with forests and agroforestry systems where people are using woody perennials for food. And then we move on to a grassland section, and that includes both perennial grassland plant foods, but then also folks who are raising animal foods on perennial pastures. And then the final section is around perennial grains and just what Aubrey has been talking about, some that have been around for a long time. There's a native Australian contributor at the beginning of that section who talks about Australian native grains that are being revitalized but have been around in his community for thousands of years. But a lot of that chapter is about this work to develop perennial grains and these collaborations among researchers at places like the Land Institute and farmers. And so we get to hear from people all across this perennial movement, as Aubrey and I see it, some of whom are growing these plants, some of whom are researching them, some are chefs who are working with them as foods and sort of talk about that piece of it and the taste profiles. But they're all personal essays. So there's, you know, a kind of factual basis, and people are telling you what they know and what they're learning. And these are like some of the most amazing experts in this work. But they're also telling you why they do it and their kind of journey of perennials as something that's really central to their sense of meaning and purpose for a bunch of different and really fascinating reasons, which we hope is helpful to readers who are also, you know, all of us are charting our own journey of meaning and purpose.
Yeah, I think each story is, each writer has a fascinating story. I think, anyway. I was enjoying reading those pieces, for sure. And now Laura and Portage been waiting a bit. We'll give you a chance to join in, Laura. Hello, what's on your mind?
Hello. Well, first of all, this is the most amazing, educational, mind-blowing show that I've listened to from you, and you've had a few before, but not like this. And so I'm thinking about whether this kind of perennial food raising would help with soil retention.
Ah, well, I think you're going to find some people who are going to agree with you on the soil retention part of things. Aubrey, you want to chime in?
Yeah, let me speak to that. I'm so glad that you made the connection between these foods and these perennial plants in soil, because that's exactly why these perennials matter so much. Our food systems depend upon our relationship with the whole earth, including the soil, and soil forms so slowly. And our more recent agricultural expansion has really left soil vulnerable to erosion in many forms. And the way that we farm leaves soil bare some of the year, and it can blow away, it can wash away. But we need the soil to be able to nurture the plants that feed us. And so being able to develop agricultural systems for crops, for pastures and grasslands, for animals, for food forests, these are all ways that these deeply rooted plants that have roots that live throughout the year, not just a portion of the year, but for multiple years, and create these really amazing, intricate relationships with the microbial communities in the soil, and that are able to pull and move water and nutrients across the soil, and that decay and turn over and feed back nutrients into the soil and move them from above ground to below ground. That sort of lively, teeming community that we don't see below us, we're really interdependent with as human creatures. So yes, being able to make those links and to think about how we can feed ourselves in ways that hold soil for us now and for future generations is really critical.
Laura, thank you very much for calling. By the way, you can join in too if you'd like a question or comment, or you could email us, but call at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Now, we picked out some, being Wisconsin-centric, we picked out some folks with Wisconsin connections who are have written for your anthology. And one of them, I think in the first section relating to forestry, was Keith Keeley, who is from Madison, Wisconsin. And he wrote something that's called From the Fringe, I think. Tell us, you know, to give our, and I thought this would be a good way to give our listeners sort of an idea about the whole anthology, to zero in on a few. Tell us about his story and what, why you brought it to the book.
Yeah. So Keith, I think we talked about a little earlier in the show, he's the executive director of the Savannah Institute, and he writes really beautifully about his process of learning that the upper Midwest has historically been a savanna ecosystem with trees dotting these grasslands, and realizing that he wanted to participate in bringing that kind of ecosystem back and planting trees on farms. And he tells the story of his very first experiment with perennial farming, where he gathers a bunch of friends and they plant some fruit and nut trees in these widely spaced rows in the middle of a hayfield. And he's really excited at first, but then he gets discouraged about, you know, trying to make a go of it farming like this, you know, economically in a Midwestern farm economy that's become really dominated by, you know, sort of large scale, large input corn and soy. So he goes on this whole journey, and he goes to graduate school, and then he finds himself working at the Savannah Institute. And, you know, the last scene in the essay, he goes back to this farm where he had originally planted these trees, and he looks around and he sees that there's something new on the neighbor's farm, you know, and so he kind of looks a little closer and he sees that, sure enough, you know, they have been planting perennial tall grass prairie and trees. And I love this essay of Keith's because I think it's kind of about the change at the pace of perennials. You know, when you tackle these big, ambitious changes, you don't necessarily see the fruits of your labor right at the beginning. But, you know, those plants that Keith put in the ground all those years ago, they have been over time bearing fruit. And now, you know, he's starting to see this ripple out as he's seeing more and more farms get interested in perennials as they see, you know, what's happening on some of these early adopter farms.
Yeah, it's a pretty cool piece. I liked it a lot. Henry in Madison has a comment for us, I believe, or a question. Let's go there. Hi, Henry.
Hey. Yeah, so my question is relating to perennial cover crops and continuous cover crop systems. We've heard a lot about how perennial crops can be super beneficial, but certainly we rely on, you know, crops like corn and soybeans, which aren't perennials, but could be in a continuous cover crop system. What are your ideas about perennial cover crops, such as like clovers or thyme, stuff like that, in current agricultural systems?
Sure.
Yeah, that's a great question.
Yeah, go ahead, Aubrey.
Sure, I'll chime in. Yes, if we think about the work of a neighboring state over in Minnesota at the Forever Green Institute and the naming of the kind of continuous living cover, like what does it mean to start to bring cover year round into these cropping systems? I think that there's an opportunity for even within the longstanding annual crop systems that we have to start to build and introduce perenniality into those. And if we think of, as Liz was just reflecting on, the scale and pace of the transition that's needed and how much ground needs to transition and the kinds of systems and structures economically, socially that also need to transition, I think there's a lot of opportunities to think about what are the tools that could be helpful in that transition process. So being able to start to introduce perennials and cover crops and to be able to hold soil and preserve some of those benefits can help make the transition into the featuring even more diverse and perennial options as these are developed. So I think that it could be a stepping stone.
Somebody, I'm forgetting which anthology, somebody wrote and mentioned the Wisconsin Integrated Cropping System. And the research on that over, I think it was like 30 years, shows that annual cropping systems will always be a carbon source, not a carbon sink, which kind of gets to a little of what you were talking about.
I think our contributor, Laura Payne, was writing about that in her essay, which is titled From Corn Belt to Pasture. And she is also thinking at a broad regional scale about the kind of transition that's needed agriculturally in these landscapes and thinking about what's possible to make tweaks within systems, but also where you need to be able to make what she calls a course correction to really think in a deep and systematic way about the changes that are needed. And I think that's where being able to imagine and create new options as well as to restore some of the things that we do know about managed grazing systems and prairie-based food systems and forest-based food systems as we also develop grain options can be a really exciting prospect. But as Laura reflects on the pace of her work as a longtime agricultural educator and working in extension and market development, who's also a farmer and manages land, she's thinking about over the course of her life the kind of work that's needed and the time it takes to do that and invest in it. So I think we all have to have a sense of patience and urgency about this and think about what options we can pursue right now, too.
And she raises grain-fed beef on pasture, right? Am I right on that? I think what she does for her farm. She gets into corn quite a bit. If I'm not mistaken, and what's wrong with corn the way we do it now? She talks about that.
Yeah, I mean, she also writes about this big journey, and she talks about this contrast that she saw as a young woman. She was lucky as a young person to go do these studies of railroad prairies, and so she was out, studying these little prairie remnants that existed where, you know, railroads had had land access. And back in the day, they didn't have the capacity to sort of plow up everything. And so there's these interesting kind of little prairie remnants along these railway corridors. And so she was studying those, and she was just really struck by the difference between that ecosystem and how it functioned and what she was kind of seeing around her as so much of the Midwest was transitioning to sort of more and more of these corn and soy monocultures. And the difference that she was noticing was sort of what Aubrey was talking about, how the railroad prairies, which had all these perennials mixed in, were building up all this healthy soil. And that meant that they were better at sort of soaking in the rain when it came, but also holding the water water for when it was dry, and the soil didn't blow around quite so much. And they also, the plants just grew on their own without any fertilizer, without needing to have herbicide to keep the plants in balance. All these things, she was just noticing the incredible elegance of these diverse, mostly perennial prairies in comparison to the monocultures that she saw needed so much of this, like tillage and inputs, and meanwhile we're losing organic matter. And so she was reflecting on all of that, and went on her own, you know, journey as a farmer many years later. And she said it was, you know, kind of obvious what direction her farm needed to go, that it really hadn't been the best land for cropping. And so it made sense for her to transition it to pasture and do grass-fed beef instead. And over time, just sort of seeing how that system helped build up the soil, she started reflecting on the difference between Wisconsin and Illinois, because she's got family in both places and she drives back and forth, and wondering, you know, couldn't places like Illinois have a balance of pasture land that looks more like places like Wisconsin? And then she, you know, gives all these statistics about what that would mean for various natural resources.
Yeah, I think it's about, what is about half and half here in Wisconsin, or 60-40, something like that, whereas there it's like 90-10, I think, which is, if, and I think she mentions, I mean, if they could just move that from 90-10 to more like Wisconsin, around 50-50, what a huge difference that would make to the to our food system, to our climate, and everything else.
Yeah, absolutely. And it makes sense, you know, because a lot of the corn and soy out there is destined for animal feed. So you can kind of imagine, like, well, what if we just had pasture here and we just had the animals out here on the land instead? So I think it's an inspiring vision.
To that note, we've got an email from Rebecca in Madison, who wonders if perennial grains and grasses could overtake native grasses, could they become an issue as an invasive or aggressive?
It's a great question. And I think that as new perennial grains and perennial foods are developed, this is something that people are paying attention to. What are the kinds of the ways of being of these plants? Are they, do they stay in place or do they move or spread? And how do they relate to the native ecosystems? Because I think we both need to restore grasslands and forest systems, and there are opportunities to develop perennial crops. And so I think that, yeah, being able to pay attention to those things as part of the crop development process.
And we'll take some more calls and questions. Just a reminder, though, our guests today, Liz Carlisle and Aubrey Streit Krug, together they've edited a new anthology, really interesting one. It's titled Living Roots, The Promise of Perennial Foods. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Quick reminder, next week on Garden Talk, we'll be broadcasting live from the PBS Wisconsin Garden and Green Living Expo. I'll be visiting with Lisa Johnson and Brian Hoddleston at that event on, I think it's Friday the 13th. Anyway, it's going to be a lot of fun. And we've got, I think we're sold out on the tickets. There's 400, room for 400, and that went pretty quickly. So, and it's my second to the last live in front of an audience show before I retire on June 30th. So maybe you can sneak in around noon when there'll probably be a few people leave at noon. They always often do. So you may have a chance to come see me if you were not among the final 400. So right now, though, we are talking about the book Living Roots, The Promise of Perennial Foods. And Greg in Vilas County has a comment. Let's go there. Hi, Greg.
Hi. What a wonderful show. We can always count on great information from you folks, all your highly trained professional guests, et cetera. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay, I beat you by 13 months to the retirement. Sorry about that. But, hey, I want to be the first to go down in history as we all trudge out to our gardens this spring. And, of course, in Vilas County here, that's probably more, you know, Mother's Day, maybe even after. But the food industry is taking a giant leap, and I want to be the first to mention it here on your show, probably mention it, that they are ramping up space and the world of space, commercializing space as we sit here and talk to pharmaceuticals and, of course, food. There will be large, I'm talking probably after we're gone, probably 30, 40 years from now, maybe sooner, there will be gigantic greenhouses floating around the earth with perennials, with tomatoes, with everybody. Everybody's going to grow in space, and it'll be a constant temperature they can work with, constant sunlight, constant, you know, they'll even have a synthetic version of water.
Wow. Well, I don't think that's any part of your book, but Greg, thanks. So what do you think? Is that the way the world's going to look in 30, 40 years, should it look the way you're hoping it'll look with? If we can become a perennial farm country or world, what's that going to mean for our climate, for our living here on this earth?
Yeah. I mean, so I think our best shot is right here on Earth. Or maybe I just like it here. You know, we as humans, we evolved with all of our friends here on this planet. And so I think, you know, moving towards more perennial foods, it's just part of like getting to know the neighborhood that we live in, this planet, this Earth, and how it works. We have inherited just such genius from evolution, and some of the beings that have been here longer than we have, like plants and like perennials. And so I think in many ways, we're kind of a young species. We're just kind of getting to know our way around this place. And my hope is that, you know, moving to growing and eating more perennials and really learning from the genius of the ecosystems around us is part of us kind of maturing into, you know, being part of the earthly community. So I'm still really hopeful about our future here on Earth.
I am as well. I'm wondering, here's another email. Why did we annualize these plants in the first place? Somebody's wondering.
That's a great question.
Why did we?
That's a great question. And there are ideas I don't know that we know, but if we think about where and how annual grain agriculture developed, the centers of origin of these crop development hotspots were often in river valleys and wetlands where there's a natural disturbance because of movement of water and floods, and annual plants do really well there. So it might have just been geographic proximity. It might have also been that because annual plants don't have to be replanted each year, it was easier to make selections from them versus a perennial system. You can just keep harvesting those seeds to eat, and you wouldn't be picking from among them. They're naturally going to grow back. And it would have taken a lot of work to actually take out ones from that population and pick from others. Mm-hmm. So not sure, but we do have to contend with the reality of where we are right now. And we have an opportunity to reflect on that and to think in some intentional ways about how we can evolve, as Liz was saying, as creatures who are interdependent with these other species and places.
You know, as you were talking, I was thinking about your keynote speaker at the Perennial Farm Gathering, who is Wendy Johnson, and her piece was titled, "I See More Life Than Ever Before," something like that. And she does get into the role that legislation and the government plays in agriculture, and she goes back a long ways to Earl Butz, who was Secretary of Agriculture, get big or get out kind of approach to farming, and how our policies, the policies that we have as a country or any country has, drastically affects what farmers do. Maybe talk. Yeah. Go ahead. Talk and maybe just talk about her entire piece, because I think it's really I would love to hear her speak as well. She is your keynote speaker at the event in March.
Everybody should come out to Dubuque to the Perennial Farm Gathering to hear Wendy Johnson. Absolutely. And yeah, I mean, I think she's lived these policies because she grew up on a family farm in Iowa during the farm crisis. And it was really, really tough for her family. She talks about how, you know, they didn't have a lot of money. They qualified for welfare. And her dad worked so much that she hardly saw him. So she didn't see a huge future for herself in agriculture. She moved away and had a career in fashion in LA, actually. And but then when her grandma died in 2009, she started worrying about, you know, losing the land out of their family. And she realized she felt a really strong connection to that land and that place. And also in the context of the climate change that she was seeing all around her as California was going up in flames every summer, she wanted to do something to steward that land that would make a difference to these environmental problems that she was really concerned about. So she went back to this family farm, kind of had to cajole her partner a little bit because he was a big time surfer, but that worked out. And she transitioned 25 acres to organic, but it was hard because, you know, she had two big seasons with a lot of rain and it washed away her organic corn and soy plants. And so that's when she turned towards perennials as a farming system that would be more resilient to climate change. And she started by raising lamb on pasture. She planted a micro orchard of apples and chestnuts. She started experimenting with kerns of perennial grain that Aubrey was talking about earlier. And I love Wendy's voice as a writer. She's such a farmer. She's so direct, you know, like she's not going to sugarcoat anything. Like all of this is in process. But to me, it's just such a tangible act of courage and hope that she gets up every day and tries to figure out how to leave the land in better shape for the next generation. And she is one of the things she's really passionate about on the policy side is crop insurance, because she's seen how that works for the corn and soy that she's still working with her dad on their other acres that haven't transitioned, and how, you know, crop insurance basically is the guaranteed income there and the banks love it and all of that. But she doesn't get good crop insurance for the plants that are actually reducing her risk. So she's been really vocal in sort of asking for crop insurance reform at the federal level.
When I was reading her, her piece, I was thinking about the farm I grew up on, and it sounds a lot like, you know, and this is a long time ago, of course, it sounds a lot like the farm we had, because she grazes cattle, some sheep, she's got ducks and chickens and turkey, she has a wool fiber business, which we didn't have, she has apples and pears and chestnuts. And a lot of this is perennial, and so she's got a kind of an income throughout the year. So she's got money coming in from one source or another throughout the year, which is kind of the way we did it when I was on the farm all those years ago.
It's great. Yeah. Yeah. And I love how her essay, you can just kind of hear that, like, there's just all this noise from all these different animals. There's all these different things growing. You know, she talks about how sometimes she has to kind of prepare the people who come out to the farm to buy meat, that it's not necessarily going to look like just one thing in a bunch of meat rows, that it's just kind of like, vroom, you know, life just kind of happening everywhere. And when you talk to Wendy, you can tell that she's a person with a lot of energy that likes to be in that kind of environment with a lot of vibrancy and stuff going on.
How do people get your book, and how do people attend? You got to go online for that, I'm sure, for the event. In the last 30 seconds.
Check out the Savannah Institute's website for information about the Perennial Farm Gathering coming up in March, the 11th through the 13th in Northeast Iowa in Dubuque. And amazing gathering of researchers, practitioners, artists, all kinds of people. I think there'll be some great and tell some great stories and some great community opportunities for learning there. And then Living Roots is being published on March 3rd with Island Press, which is now with Princeton University Press. So check out bookshop.org and look for Living Roots, or go to your local bookseller and ask for a copy, or your local library.
Yeah. And we will be at Lake City Books on March 16th for an event as well. So they'll definitely have copies of the book.
Go to Lake City Books.
Lake City Books. All right. Thank you both very much. It's been a great hour, Liz and Aubrey, and hopefully we can talk again. I really enjoyed visiting with you. Liz Carlisle and Aubrey Strike Krug, their book, Living Roots, The Promise of Perennial Foods. Thank you so much for listening. Always fun to have you listening in, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.